Furlong Reel 2. Apart from the material set up at Hendon, what do you remember about the various pioneer aviators who set up their schools there? Like Hall himself, for example. What kind of chap was he?
Well, Hall, of course, was a god to we pupils. He was a quiet sort of chap. I suppose he was between 25 and 30. He didn't say a lot. He did very little in the actual training of his pupils. He left that to an instructor. He did give me my first flight, and I think I have a recollection that he gave me a discount on the charge, the fee for flying, because I produced cash. All aviators in those days were hard up, or appeared to be. They spent money pretty freely, and they were a bit careless about debts and so on. I remember Hall borrowed my helmet and goggles one time, and I never saw them back again. He often promised to produce them, but I never got them. But otherwise, they were nice enough people, but that was one of their failings.
Any others there that stick in your mind? What about Clarence Winchester? I believe he was active at Hendon at this time.
Well, my recollection of Clarence Winchester is that he was a freelance pilot with his own aeroplane, giving rides, joy rides to people for something like a pound a time.
What kind of aeroplane did he have?
Well, I'm not sure what it was. I can't recall what his aeroplane was. It was a obviously a two-seater, a four-and-a-half two-seater, let's say one sat behind the other. But I remember his technique very clearly, because he used to put the passenger in the aeroplane and then start frightening them to death by telling them that they mustn't touch this, and whatever they do, not to lean against that. And that wire was absolutely death if they got tangled up with it. And by the time they took off, they were a jelly. And when we asked him afterwards why he did this, he said, well, they think they get their money's worth if they're really frightened. And this was his technique all along. Well, then there was Graham White, of course, a very well-known character. I knew him by sight very well, and he used to do quite a lot of training. And I remember one particular occasion when a taxi or a car came bowling into the airfield. Out jumps Graham White and a lady, and they dashed into his office, shut the door, and a few moments later up comes a taxi with Ethel Levy on board, Ethel Levy being perhaps the best-known musical comedy actress of the time. She came up, banged on the door, went in, and we were entertained by a lot of noise and shouting and banging and so on going on in this office, and then the first lady came out, got in Ethel Levy's taxi and hooted off. What happened, we don't know, but it was all very entertaining to us.
I suppose, really, it wasn't surprising that a good deal of sport of this kind went on, because my impression is that all of the people who were involved in aviation at this time were pretty young.
Yes, they were all young, and they were all high-spirited, and, of course, the girls were very attracted to the men, and I'm afraid the men took advantage of it. That's what it came to. So there were always girls hanging around the airfield. I was too young and too impecunious at the time to enter into this side of it, but I used to watch the others at it.
Mm. Do you think, evidence that at that time flying and things associated with flying was sort of glamour kind of activity?
Oh, very much so.
Had that kind of
very
ethos.
Much so, yes. Oh, yes, the girls used to hang around pretty freely, like they do around the pop singers now. This was something really... they used to come up in droves sometimes, these girls.
Any other kinds of hangers-on in addition to the ladies?
No, I don't think so. There were always the schoolboys around, if they could get in, of course, poking their nose into everything. After all, I wasn't much more than a schoolboy myself. But that's what...
What sort of feature did the air displays at Hendon play in your life and the lives of the people, the aviators working at Hendon?
Well, of course, it was a new sport, and as I said, it was very short of money, so they held displays whenever they could. The airfield, incidentally, I think belonged to Graham White, or he rented it, and they used to put on shows as frequently as they could, and they were very well attended, as far as I can recollect.
Would that be sort of weekly or monthly or what?
Well, I believe almost every decent weekend during the summer, particularly, of course, bank holidays and the like. But I think they were fairly frequent. My recollection is practically every week. Mm.
Did they advertise these shows in any
Yes,
way?
They were, I suppose, in the papers. But everybody was aware of the fact that if you wanted to see aeroplanes, that was the place to go to. Mm. And there was room for cars, not that there were a lot of cars about in those days, but there were buses and trains and whatnot that you could get to Hendon fairly simply. Oh yes, I think the attendance, my recollection is, they were pretty good.
Could you give me any impressions of the scale of the public interest that it rose? I mean, would you be dealing on a flying display day with hundreds or thousands?
Oh, thousands, I should think. On a good day, it varied, of course. On a good day, especially if there was a special attraction, which, of course, they always tried to produce something special like they did now. Parachute drop or possibly some spectacular thing like throwing bags of flour at something on the airfield. Anything to make a variation. But the main feature, as far as I can recall, was this racing round the pylons.
What was involved in that?
Well, these six or eight pylons, I think it was six, you would take off, the pilots would take off, and they would have to do so many circuits. And, of course, there was handicapping went on. These slower machines went off first, and they would tear around these, and mind you, they used to fly very close to the ground. The best pilots would fly with their wingtip 3 feet from the ground and 3 feet from the pylon as they went round the corner on pretty steep banks. And this, of course, made very spectacular flying, especially as you remember the pilots were sitting out in the open mostly. You could almost see the expression on his face, and you could see him peering over his shoulder to see where the next fellow was. And then they'd dodge over the man in front when they overtook, and that sort of thing. And although it was so spectacular and apparently dangerous, I don't ever remember a crash. They must have had them, but not while I was there.
How did they overtake each other?
Well, they overtook. They didn't dare go underneath because they were too low, but over the top was the usual thing. You would get behind the chap, try and get in his blind spot, apparently, climb up behind him and then dive down in front of him, frighten the daylights out of him so that he swung out of the circuit, if possible, and you took his place. That seemed to be the drill.
Was it very cutthroat or was it very friendly?
Yes.
How serious?
I think it was friendly, but it looked terribly cutthroat. Obviously, certain people were well known for their ability to overtake the other chap. They may have had a faster aeroplane or their skill was greater. But certain names were well known, I can't recall them now, as being pretty good at this game. And, of course, the more spectacular they could make it, the bigger the draw. And there's no doubt it was a tremendous draw. You don't see anything like it nowadays.
Do you have any particular recollections of the other schools apart from the Hall School of which you were a pupil?
Yes. There were numerous occasions when inventors appeared, some of the most crazy ideas. One in particular I recall where a man turned up with a propeller which the tips were bent right back over the boss, quite a long way back. And he went to the school next door, the Ruffy Bowman School, and talked to the one of them, I don't know which, and persuaded them to fit his propeller, which they did. It was on a 45-head Zani, I think. Well, in those days, they tested the pull of the engine by by tying a spring balance to the tail and anchoring the other end of it to a stake, and then you'd hang over the spring balance and see how much pull was shown. Well, on this occasion, they got this rigged up with a mechanic sitting in the cockpit operating the controls, and then this thing opened up. Well, we pupils of the next door school, we stood on edge of this propeller, the side of the wing, so to speak, and watched the blades straighten up when the load came on. They just got straighter and straighter, and we were standing there amazed when all of a sudden there was a horrible cracking and crunching noise. The whole engine, complete with all its entrails, leapt out of the aircraft, shot straight forward. It was a bit nose up, of course, as it stood on the ground. It shot up into the air about 25, 30 feet, and it was a... I beg your pardon, I said it was an Anzani. It wasn't. It was a rotary engine. It was a... must have been a gnome engine, because the engine was going round. And it hit the ground about 50 or so feet ahead, and then it leapt into the air in a most spectacular fashion and shot up to about 100 feet right down the way and landed with a crash in the pathway. When Mr. Ruffy or Mr. Bowman, whoever it was hanging over the spring balance, when they straightened up and realised what had happened and looked round, the inventor had vanished, and they were left with an aeroplane with no front end and a smashed up engine a couple of hundred yards away. Well, then there was Geoffrey de Havilland, who we knew by sight, and his aircraft were being made there, and the unique thing about him was, I think, that he not only designed, but he tested all his aircraft in the air, particularly the original tests. And I well remember him testing the DH-2, which in its day was a very spectacular aircraft and made a great name for itself in France. He was an unassuming man, as he was all the rest of his life. But this was something that really did impress me, the fact that the man tested all his own aircraft, which meant he had a great deal of faith in them.
Was this unusual with the early airplane designers?
Well, they usually, with the actual manufacturing ones, I mean, the early designers made one off and then flew it. But the people who made them sort of mass production, I don't think they tested them.
Did you come into contact with any other of the pioneer aviators?
Yes, I used to go to classes held by...
Northern Polly, wasn't it?
Yes, I can't think the man's name at the moment.
Hanley Page.
Hanley Page, yes. The famous Hanley Page. And he was a wonderful lecturer because he kept our attention by having sex references in his thing. For instance, he used to say when the centre of pressure got near to the centre of attraction, then things worked, you see, that sort of thing. And he was a very good talker. And I remember at a social event one time, Hanley Page was a rather beautiful young girl was presented to Hanley Page, and she had on her dress a model aeroplane, and she was proudly showing this off to him, and she said, "Do you like my aeroplane?" Well, he says, "As a matter of fact, I wasn't looking at the aeroplane, I was looking at the landing ground." There was another man, I can't recall his name, but he was a circus performer, or had been. And we knew this because he had a bald place on the top of his head, and we used to chide him about this and say, "How'd you get this?" He said, "Well, one of my turns was to spin on my head," and he'd worn the hair out. But this chap attributed his long life to the fact that no matter what sort of a crash he had, he could land on his feet. I don't remember him crashing, but he was a terrific character and used to entertain us at times by doing circus tricks when he wasn't flying.
Can we continue now talking about your actual flying training? Now, the whole school you've already mentioned used Codrons. Well, what were they like to fly?
Well, the Caudron was a small French aeroplane with warping wings as opposed to ailerons. In other words, the wings were bent in order to get lateral control. It was a small nacelle as opposed to a cockpit. In other words, you sat in the back end of a wooden bath, and the engine was stuck on the front. And because there were open booms to the tail, it flew reasonably well, but we only had 35 horse, and we used to say that if one horse died, you did two. Actually, you could notice if it misfired on one cylinder, you could feel the aeroplane drop. That's how near we were to the stall point. In fact, the stall point and the top speed were very nearly the same. So that the engine was going, that's why the throttle was wide open, of course. The engine was going flat out all the time we're flying, and the moment you blipped, in other words, switched off for a fraction, the thing came down almost like coming down steps. So that, but my knowledge of flying, of course, was negligible, so I thought it was good, but whether it was or not, I don't know.
Any other characteristics of this particular aeroplane that you can remember?
No, it used to burn castor oil, which of course...